Chapter 4. The alarm on my Z-phone woke me up at 0430. At the latitude of northern Maine, the sun rose just after 0500 that time of year, and I wanted to be on the road before first light. My breakfast and lunch were in the fridge, and all my other gear was in a duffel bag, so I stuffed the food in the duffel and quietly went out the back door, walking carefully around puddles so my boots would not squish on the soggy back lawn. It wasn't quite drizzling, and the droplets of water in the air sticking to my eyelashes were larger than typical fog. By the faint light shining through the woods from the McCarran's house, I could see the moisture in the air. 53 degrees was exactly what the weather forecast had predicted. It was going up to nearly 70 if the clouds burned off, which I wasn't counting on. In northern Maine, when the weather forecast is wrong, it is always wrong in the crappy direction. I did not care. There was a light on in the trailer parked beside the barn. When I was in the kitchen, I could see lights in the RV parked out front also. That didn't worry me. Skippy had disabled the motion sensors and invisible lasers, or whatever the security team used to keep track of me. In the wee hours of the morning and in the crappy weather, no one expected me to be out of bed, because sleeping is what normal people do. The security team assured me they were for my protection, and not because the government didn't trust me. And I figured they truly were there partly to keep nutcases away from my family, so I didn't protest. When I got into the woods behind my parents' house, I could walk faster because the ground sloped up and there were no puddles for me to squish in and make noise. In my foolish confidence, I assumed I could walk through those woods in the darkness because I had been there so many times and knew that path so well I could have walked it blindfolded. It was a surprise when I had to hold up a hand to push clusters of wet branches away from my face, and when I bashed my forehead into a tree limb. While I had spent many, many hours in those woods, none of those hours had been recently, and by recently, I mean since before I shipped out to Nigeria. Even in the dark days after Columbus Day and before the X-Force went off-world, I had been serving with the National Guard and only visited my parents once or twice. It was a surprise to me how much those woods had changed. Many of the large trees had been cut for firewood, leaving gaps in the canopy for new growth to spring up in the sunlight. There was a lot more underbrush than I remembered, and I stumbled often, feeling fortunate that most of the dead branches had been picked up by my parents to use as kindling, so I didn't step on anything that would make a loud noise when it snapped. My gloves were in the duffel bag, and I did not feel like fumbling around for them in the dark. I endured the occasional scrapes and scratches on my bare hands and kept going. The underbrush was sopping wet from the overnight rain, and my pants were soon soaked from slogging through that damned invasive Japanese stilt grass that was growing everywhere because the deer didn't like to eat it. By the time I got through the woods and onto the old farm road, my socks were wet inside my waterproof boots from water dripping down my drenched pants legs. On the road, which had ruts and potholes that had not changed, I picked up my pace, and soon stepped onto the paved road where my friend Tom Paulson had parked his old Jeep, with the keys under a rock behind a tree just where he said they would be. It was an old YJ, the kind with the unfortunate square headlights. The roof seams leaked, the driver's side window rattled, unless you pressed your elbow against it, and the shocks needed to be replaced. But it was available, and Tom had tied a canoe to the roof, so it looked great to me. It looked like freedom. Tom had warned me the starter motor made a grinding noise, and the last thing I needed was to make noise. Releasing the parking brake and putting the gear shift in neutral, I pushed it out onto the road, and when it got rolling down the hill by itself, I hopped in and popped the clutch to start it. The engine fired right up. Until I got to the bottom of the hill and made the turn to the right, I kept the headlights off and just coasted along. The headlights illuminated two glaring cones through the mist. The droplets were so big I could see individual spheres of condensed water vapor dancing in the light, moving randomly, until the flat front of the Jeep disturbed the air so they moved up to splatter against the windshield. When the weather was warm, Tom liked to fold down the windshield and drive that way, although one time I was with him when he did that, and he got smacked in the face with a big June bug that must have weighed 5 pounds. I kept the windshield right where it could fulfill its purpose of shielding me from wind, rain, and bugs. And watching the mist was hypnotic. I had to be careful not to get distracted by the brightly shining pinpricks of light that swirled and rushed toward my eyes. It was still mostly dark, and the last thing I needed was to hit a deer. Or a moose. With one hand, I dug into my duffel for a thermos of coffee, unscrewed the top, and drank. It was still hot. Life was good. When I got the canoe out on the lake, the mist had changed into a steady drizzle, and gray fog lay low on the water. I paddled away from shore, then drifted, watching raindrops gently dance on the surface as I drank from the thermos. The light drizzle fell so softly upon the surface the ripples on the calm water merged before I could follow them with my eyes. Shaking my wet jacket sleeves sent large droplets into the water. I watched those circular ripples spread out, slowly fading away as the drizzle wore them down. Because I was wearing a wide-brimmed hat, I could eat muffins my mother baked without getting them wet, and I knew to tuck my hands under my chin to keep them dry. There I was, sitting in a canoe in the rain, the sun barely lightening the sky in the east, my breath visible in the wispy fog. A few feet away there was a splash much larger than a raindrop where a fish broke the surface. Dark pine and fir trees lined the shore, interspersed with maples whose branches hung out over the water. I could not remember the last time I had felt so peaceful. Before I was in high school, my father took me on a canoe trip along the Allegash River and the chain of lakes up there. We went with a group. I remember there was a moose standing in the water close to shore and we got too close. My father and I had to paddle like hell to get away from the enraged moose while people in the other canoes laughed at us. And that was a great time. Even the day when the wind blew hard right in our faces and all the other people pulled their canoes along the shoreline in the shallow water. Not my dad and me. We stayed out there and paddled one stroke after another, barely making headway against the gusty wind. And when we got to our campsite for the evening, half an hour ahead of everybody else, by the way, my arms were like rubber. But I felt great. Remembering that day and fishing trips with my father, I ate muffins, drank hot coffee from the thermos, and watched the rain fall silently all around me. Flying Dutchman, this is resupply flight uniform Sierra 907. The pilot concentrated more on keeping his tone of voice casual than the instruments in front of him. He was fully, supremely confident in his ability to fly the Krestang Dragon A dropship up to the pirate starship in low orbit, less than 5,000 miles above the Earth's surface. On training flights and then missions to ferry equipment and scientists up to the captured Krestang troopship Yu-Kishan, the pilots had flown most of the way to the moon, so low orbit was not much of a challenge. The UN had a major project to move the Kishan into low orbit, to make it more accessible for study. But the science and engineering teams aboard that captured ship were still trying to understand how the reactors worked. Until the Kishan could move under its own power, it would be staying right where it was. The UN would not risk bringing the precious ship near the planet if there was even the slightest chance it could crash and be lost. Any possibility for loss of life on Earth if the ship fell out of orbit was a minor concern compared to the vital technology aboard that ship. Reporting as fully ready for departure. In the Combat Information Center of the Flying Dutchman, currently high over the Texas Gulf Coast and headed east-northeast, the flight operations duty officer's shoulders tensed when she heard the code phrase, reporting as fully ready. There was no need to say reporting as fully, and it was not standard communications procedure for a ground-to-orbit flight. The phrase had been chosen because it was unlikely to be used except as a code, but was ordinary enough not to raise suspicions. That was the hope, anyway. The duty officer at the flight ops station had learned that the alien AI seemed to see, hear, and know everything that went on aboard and around the pirate ship. Roger that, U.S. 907, the duty officer forced a somewhat bored tone in her voice. No other traffic in the area. We have you cleared all the way in for docking Bay 2.
Cleared all the way in for Bay 2, understood. 907 is rolling. We have your guidance beam 5x5.
The pilot lifted his right thumb off the control panel to indicate the go order to his co-pilot. The phrase, all the way in, was the proper response code for the operation. If the flight ops officer in orbit had not responded with that code phrase, the pilots of the Dragon had been instructed to fake a mechanical problem with their dropship and abort the assault. If the merry band of pirates were expecting trouble, the Dragon did not have a chance to get the assault team aboard the ship successfully. The payload would be unloaded and replaced by innocuous supplies needed for a deep space mission, and the Dragon would innocently perform its official resupply function. A later flight would attempt the assault. That was the original plan. Now, the timeline had been accelerated for reasons the pilots had not been told. They needed to go now. Right now. Turning in his seat while the co-pilot continued pre-flight procedures, the pilot gave a thumbs up to the payload.
The payload leader gave a silent thumbs up to acknowledge the signal. All communications were conducted by hand signals in case the AI above was listening. Instead of supply crates requested by Lieutenant Colonel Sims, the Dragon was loaded down with a 7-man assault team wearing Krestang-powered armor. The assault team, part of Delta Force from nearby Fort Bragg, had loaded aboard the Dragon in its special hangar under Pope Army Airfield, away from sight, and hopefully even away from the all-seeing senses of the alien AI aboard the Flying Dutchman. The hangar was deep underground and had no cameras or communications equipment that might be used by a hostile or even indifferent intelligence. Whether that was true or not was something the assault team would learn only when they got out of the Dragon in the Dutchman's docking bay. The op was, in the professional opinion of the Delta team leader, a hastily thrown together mess. They could count on help from only a handful of people aboard the ship. The others were blissfully ignorant of the plan. None of the Delta team had ever been aboard the Dutchman, and training had been limited to one day in a hangar at Pope Airfield using tape on the floor to outline passageways, bulkheads, and hatchways. Rodriguez assumed he would have to adapt to the situation as it developed and hope for the best. The co-pilot cupped a hand around the microphone that wrapped around toward his mouth and waited for the pilot to do the same. "Does this sit right with you?" The pilot's eyes automatically flicked up and back to the flight recorder that had been installed on the rear bulkhead of the cockpit, the bright orange device awkwardly bolted and strapped in place. The status light of the device was off, the power cable having been severed. The Dragon had its own flight recorder system, but humans were still trying to learn the dropship's subsidiary systems, with little help from the AI. The only reason humans on Earth could fly dropships at all was through instruction by pilots who had served with the Merry Band of Pirates on previous missions. Again, the AI had been almost no help with flight instruction, giving one lame excuse after another about not being able to share technical secrets with a species it arrogantly considered to be monkeys. "Following orders sits right with me," the pilot answered as his eyes narrowed, coolly considering his right seater. "Dan." The co-pilot shook his head slightly, keeping the gesture controlled so anyone watching would not think there was a problem in the cockpit. "The pirates saved the planet. Now we're taking the ship from them?" "It's not their ship," the pilot said with practiced patience, measuring his words, because he too did not like their assigned mission. They had trained for a mission to retake the Flying Dutchman in case it was ever seized by a foreign power. The mission they had trained for did not involve taking control of the ship away from the crew who had served aboard her for years. Now they were ordered to do exactly that. The mission they were on now had been thrown together at the last minute. "We don't have the big picture. Command wouldn't have ordered this op unless some bad shit is going to hit the fan." "The French and Chinese birds are down," the lead pilot mused. "And our other Dragon is out of position up at the Kishan." China, France, and the United States had the only fully operational dropships on the planet, other than the ships assigned to the Flying Dutchman. When the go order was given, the Dragons controlled by France and China were not flightworthy as they were undergoing heavy maintenance, and the other Dragon controlled by America was aboard the Yukishan with the mostly civilian engineering team there. "It's up to us." To avoid comms being tapped by the alien AI, all orders had to be given and confirmed face-to-face, a procedure that did not allow for optimal timing. "Roger that." Daniel Pope reluctantly sat back in the co-pilot's seat and released his microphone. The two pilots completed the pre-flight procedures, received clearance from the tower, and the Dragon roared into the sky for its rendezvous with the pirate ship. Captain Samantha Reed was bored. 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 After the week of debriefing at Wright Pat, she had been granted 2 weeks of leave with the promise of another 2 weeks at an unspecified future date. Sammy Fireball Reed assumed either her future leave would get canceled if she was assigned to the Flying Dutchman again, or she could have her choice of next assignment and could take the leave when she wanted. With two Maxulk ships soon headed toward Earth, she was betting the Dutchman would not be remaining long in orbit, one way or the other. About the prospect of another flight aboard the pirate ship, she had seriously mixed feelings. If the plan was to contact the senior species and throw humanity at the non-existent mercy of those supremely powerful beings, she wanted no part in that suicide mission. A suicide mission for all of humanity. If the Dutchman was going back out to kill those two Maxulk ships, or whatever crazy-ass scheme the Colonel dreamed up, she would be 110% in favor of that mission. But, she admitted to herself, She did not know whether she wanted to go on another mission that meant being stuck again inside the slowly deteriorating starship for many months, even years. If she was ordered to go, then she would. If she thought her unique experience could help ensure the success of the mission, then she would go whether she was happy about it or not. But the Merry Band of Pirates had plenty of qualified pilots, and there were hundreds, probably thousands, of pilots on Earth eager for and deserving of a chance to fly to the stars. Did she need to go? She loved flying free of gravity's grasping bonds, loved that she had saved their nearly disastrous first refueling mission by discovering how to manually fly the drogue chute. She was proud of what she had achieved, and she felt a strong sense of loyalty to Colonel Bishop. That did not mean she wanted to spend the rest of her life in a composite tube monotonously jumping through interstellar space with moments of sheer gut-wrenching terror. 3 nights before, she had been out with friends and met a cute guy, an Army Ranger. At first, she assumed he was sucking up to her because he wanted a recommendation to join the Merry Band of Pirates, but it quickly became clear the guy was clueless about who she was. With her wearing civilian clothes and with mostly civilian friends, he had not recognized her from her brief appearances in the media after the Dutchman returned. The military had limited press access to the returning pirates, so that only a few officers had to endure giving pre-digested answers to the same old dumb questions, and Sammy's face had fortunately not been all over social media. The guy was cute and not at all dumb, and when he blushed after realizing who she was, he had adorable dimples. They had plans to go out to dinner 2 nights later. Then Colonel Bishop had requested she cut short her leave and fly back up to the Dutchman ASAP to oversee the crew working to restock and refit the ship. Technically, Skippy had requested there always be at least 2 pirates aboard the ship at all times because the beer can was uncomfortable with new people. In reality, her presence aboard the ship was because Bishop did not trust new people he didn't know. He didn't trust them not to be clumsy and break their rebuilt Frankenship, and he flat out did not trust them. With the governments of Earth peeing in their pants about the idea of Maxalt's starships suddenly appearing in the sky and turning the surface of humanity's home into radioactive slag, Bishop did think they might try something rash and stupid. Sammy resented being whisked away from a normal life to babysit a bunch of newbies in orbit. But damn it, she and all the pirates had worked hard to build the ship out of spare parts, and no way was she letting anyone screw with it. Besides, Bishop had sworn she only needed to be aboard the ship for 3 days until Lieutenant Commander Williams arrived to relieve her. Walking back from the galley where she had enjoyed a surprisingly good breakfast, her thoughts were interrupted. "Hey, Fireball!" Skippy's voice rang in her earpiece. "Skippy, I asked you not to call me that. Captain Reed or Sammy will do fine." "Yeah, and I asked for a puppy, but did I get one?"
"No."
Sammy came to a halt in the passageway.
"What would you do with a puppy?"
"That was a joke, Fireball. Although, hey, getting a puppy would be a great idea."
"No, it would be a terrible idea."
Sammy found herself repeating words she had heard Bishop say too often.
"Why, puppies are cute. Having a puppy would be good for morale. He could snuggle up against me and I could keep him warm."
"Uh-huh. How are you going to care for a puppy? You can't even move yourself."
"My bots could walk the dog and feed it and, you know, clean up after it. Even a dog that sheds would be cleaner than you filthy monkeys. I will talk with Joe about—"
"No, you are not bothering Joe."
She almost used his first name. Keeping track of whether Bishop was a staff sergeant or a colonel was frustrating.
"Not bothering Bishop with your idiot ideas. You are not getting a puppy, and that's final."
"Why, because you are the mommy and you said so?"
"Skippy,"
Sammy sighed.
"What did you want before we got off the subject?"
"Oh, yeah, thank you. I almost forgot. You should go to the CIC.
"Why?"
She had been planning to use one of the flight simulators which were blessedly available now that the Dutchman was without a regular crew.
"The latest resupply flight is climbing into orbit now."
"Got it."
"Skippy, that is a routine flight. If I hang around the CIC, that will show I lack confidence in the crew there. I'm not the duty officer until 1600 today."
"Oh. Good point." The beer can sounded disappointed. "Okay, forget what I said."
Maybe I should be there so those knuckleheads flying the resupply bird don't crash into us and scratch the paint.
Where is the resupply bird now?"
"Still in Atmo. It will be here in 40 minutes.
"I have time then." Sammy suppressed an eye roll. I'll be in CIC for the docking procedure. Hans Chotek was not having a good day. In fact, it was a particularly bad day in a week that had started badly and gone downhill. He had been fired from his government position and almost entirely ostracized by former colleagues and friends. That afternoon, he was in a windowless concrete room under a security building in Paris. UNEF had brought him there 2 days ago, supposedly for more questioning, though no questions of any substance had been asked. He had not been allowed to use a phone. Indeed, the room had no communications equipment or electronics of any kind. Hans figured that was to prevent Skippy from snooping on conversations. One of his few remaining friends had just left, a colleague from Sweden who had come to check on him and to warn him of trouble coming soon. At first, Hans had been surprised she took the risk of speaking openly, until she assured him there were not any listening devices in the room, another measure to prevent the alien AI in orbit from spying on human affairs. When the door closed with a solid and fateful-sounding clang, Hans could not help a shudder of fear. Not fear for himself, fear for humanity. If only there were a way he could warn Bishop or Skippy.
"Hello, Lauren," Skippy called Captain Poole, as she was engaged in the insufferably tedious task of checking supplies against the official manifest and making sure everything was stowed correctly according to the procedures developed by Sims. Poole had heard Sims would not be signing on for another mission, a fact that made the Ranger sad, and she had to admit to herself even less eager for another endless voyage inside the composite bulkheads of the starship.
"Good morning, Skippy. What can I do for you?" she replied without taking her eyes off her tablet. She would rather have been dirtside than aboard the Flying Dutchman again, but she had agreed to spend 3 days in orbit, keeping an eye on the new crew.
"I need your help. I'm decorating my escape pod man cave, and I need stuff moved around."
That made her pause and look up.
"Decorating?"
She silently mouthed the word in amazement. Why would a beer can need... Then she realized nothing about Skippy would surprise her.
"Your bots can't do that for you?"
"No, I kind of need an opinion also."
"Trust me, you do not want my opinion about interior decorating," she snorted.
"I'm busy. Can this wait?"
It can't wait. I'll explain when you get here, but this is important and rather time-sensitive."
"Seriously?" The phrase time-sensitive bothered her. Had the idiot AI glued something to the wall and she had to remove it before the glue dried?
"No one else can do it. I'm on duty, Skippy. Plenty of people aboard are..."
"It has to be you. Trust me, Captain. This is important." She set the tablet down and secured it with a strap, proper procedure in case the ship had to maneuver suddenly or lost artificial gravity.
"Fine." Her tone meant it was not fine at all.
"If this is some idiot practical joke..."
"No joke. Please hurry. But, don't make it look like you're hurrying, okay?"
By the time Samantha Reed walked into the CIC, the resupply dragon was coming slowly and carefully through the open doors into a docking bay, its flight controlled by the automated docking system. There wasn't anything the pilots needed to do. Indeed, on a display that showed the inside of the dropship's cockpit, both pilots had their arms resting on the sides of their consoles, showing they were not touching anything important. In an emergency, they could resume manual control in a second, although in a real emergency, a second might be too late.
"Major Jones?"
Sammy approached the flight control duty officer, who was also filling in as the overall duty officer, since the starship's main reactor was shut down and the ship wasn't going anywhere.
"Captain Reed?"
Jones acknowledged the former pirate with an annoyed coolness. The CIC crew did not appreciate the ship's previous crew looking over their shoulders, especially during a procedure as routine as an automated docking. The Dutchman's AI was in complete control of the Dragon, with Skippy only on call in case of emergency. The beer can-shaped alien AI was not supposed to be even monitoring the docking procedure, so the crew could gain confidence in their abilities. Jones was skeptical the beer can could resist spying on them anyway.
"You are not on duty until 1600.
The duty officer had not bothered to look at the newcomer.
"Yes, ma'am. Just observing. I'll stay out of your way."
Sammy edged back up against the rear bulkhead of the CIC. She looked away from the displays into the darkened bridge area where the command chair and two pilot couches were empty. That would never happen under Bishop's command, unless the crew had entirely abandoned ship. Sammy could see it made little sense for pilots to stand a duty shift at the controls of a ship running on backup power.
She also had learned you never knew when some really bad shit might happen. When the universe decided to bite you on the ass, it was serious. She did not know anyone in the CIC. The only person aboard the ship she had served with was Lauren Poole, and they had not really served together, as Sammy was a pilot and Poole wore powered armor or controlled a combat in action. Still, the two sought each other out at breakfast and dinner times, comforted to have someone familiar to talk with. Poole came to mind after the Dragon settled into its secure docking clamps and the big bay doors clanged shut. As air began to rush back into the bay, Jones turned to a Chinese officer manning a console and asked, "Verify Captain Poole's location." That was odd, Sammy thought. Well, the newbies have their own procedures.
"Captain Poole is in Cargo Bay 7, the Chinese officer reported, pointing to a display showing a camera image from that bay. "She is still cataloging supplies."
A tight smile flashed across Jones's lips, and she nodded silently. "Ma'am," Sammy spoke, satisfied she was not at risk of distracting the crew during docking. The Dragon was secure and powering down, and there wasn't anything for the CIC crew to do.
"Poole knows not to approach a docking bay during pressurization. You don't need to be concerned about her safety."
Besides, Sammy knew, the ship's AI wouldn't allow anyone into the docking bay antechamber until the bay air pressure reached normal levels.
"I am not worried about Poole's safety," Jones replied. Then she astonished Sammy by pulling a sidearm out from a pocket and pointing it at Sammy. "My concern is that she does not try to interfere with us."
Suddenly, a lot of odd things she noticed over the past 2 days made sense to Captain Samantha Reed. She understood in a flash as she looked at the small semi-automatic pistol held by Jones. It looked like a .22 to Sammy's highly alert eyes, and such a weapon had little stopping power. Jones was only a few feet from her. Could she jump? No. That little pistol likely had explosive-tipped rounds that could do bad things to Sammy's insides. Slowly, she raised her arms, and Jones gestured for someone to restrain the pirate. The main CIC display showed images from the docking bay, where armor-suited figures were running out of the Dragon carrying Kristang rifles. "If this is a mutiny," Sammy began to say, "this action is fully authorized by UNEF Command and by the President of the United States directly." Jones kept an eye on the pirate, while with the hand not holding the sidearm, she flipped up a clear plastic cover and pressed a button. To her right, the Chinese officer pressed the confirmation button, and Sammy felt the deck shudder slightly. "No!" Sammy shouted in horror, realizing the CIC crew had just ejected Skippy's escape pod. With two people holding her arms firmly, she couldn't do anything.
"Are you crazy?"
"The alien is not our ally. It is using us," Jones explained, moving to another console.
"Holy shit," Sammy gasped, seeing what Jones was doing.
The officer was activating one of the point defense maser cannons and authorizing it to fire on proximity mode. Jones looked up briefly to meet Sammy's horrified gaze.
"The alien tells us it can't be harmed by conventional weapons."
"If that is true, it has nothing to worry about," Jones explained as her fingers ran through the maser startup sequence.
"Hey!"
Skippy's voice boomed painfully out of the CIC speakers.
"What are you idiot monkeys doing? I just decorated my man cave. Now you have gone and—"
Jones cut off power to the speakers.
"If it can be killed by something simple like a maser cannon, then—"
She jabbed a thumb down on the firing button.
"We don't need it anymore."
"Escape pod destroyed," the voice of the duty officer resounded in the helmet of the Delta team leader.
"Any interference from the alien?"
Team leader Rodriguez asked, slightly out of breath from the headlong run from the docking bay. Powered armor helped tremendously, but a user still needed their own muscles to control the suit, and the situation was tense. Their mission was to seize humanity's only ship capable of traveling between stars, take it away from the control of an alien AI who had demonstrated it could not be trusted. Rodriguez had doubts about whether the mission could succeed. He even had doubts about whether it should succeed, whether he and his team were doing the right thing. None of his men had expressed any reservations out loud. They didn't need to. Rodriguez knew them, knew the meaning of looks they gave, how their utter silence during the ride up from Fort Bragg had said everything that needed to be said.
"No interference, no contact at all," Jones reported.
"No contact?"
"Nothing.
We are not receiving any signals from the alien. Its connection with the ship has been severed.
Hell, Rodriguez grunted as he and three members of his team ran up the access tunnel of the ship's spine, the hatchway to the forward hull in sight. They had not dared ride the tram in case the alien took control and shut it down. The other three were racing aft toward the engineering section to connect with and secure the scientists and engineers there.
Is the alien dead? Maybe that computer worm damaged it more than it admitted.
Speculate later, Jones ordered.
Copy that. Rodriguez concentrated on getting through the hatch that was approaching fast. If the hatch was closed and locked against them, they had plasma torches for cutting through, or shape-charge explosives if they absolutely had no time to screw around. To his great relief, his team ran through the open hatch single file without any problem. It might be, the thought flashed through his mind, that the Delta team was not needed at all. They had full control of the ship already, and people who were not part of the plan posed no threat to UNEF Command's ownership of humanity's only real starship. The part of the ship they were running through was a wide and tall central passageway with double doors to cargo bays on each side. Up ahead, the wide passageway ended in a T, where his team would split again, two going left to the computer core, while Rodriguez and another would go right and forward to the CIC. With a glance downward, he verified the safety of his Kristang rifle was off. They were equipped with low-velocity rounds to avoid blowing a hole in anything important aboard the ship. That was another problem for Rodriguez to worry about. Those rounds had never been tested inside an actual Theranan starship. When he looked up again after no more than a half second, a cargo bay door had opened ahead of him, and an armor-suited figure carrying a rifle stepped out.
"Hello, boys," Lauren Poole greeted the newbies.
The FBI agent burst out the back door of the Bishop House, waving his arms toward the trailer in the driveway.
"He's gone! Joe Bishop is gone!"
"What do you mean, gone?"
the field supervisor asked from the trailer's open door, feeling an already bad morning going to shit in front of his eyes.
"Did you check in the basement?"
"Yeah, we're checking the attic now, but..."
"Yeah, shit!"
"How did he get past the motion detector and laser fencing?" the supervisor asked to himself, fearing he knew the answer to that question. Then he felt a chill up his spine. The agents should have reported from inside the house, not needing to run out the back door and shout. Pressing the transmit button on his walkie-talkie, he called out,
"Team, this is Gillis. Report in."
"Sir, comms are down."
The agent shook his own walkie-talkie with disgust, popping open the cover to check the batteries. The supervisor tossed his useless walkie-talkie on a shelf beside the door and pulled a cell phone out of a pocket. 4 bars. That was good. They had installed a new cell tower in the area just to support the security detail. His phone had an app that would have alerted him if the phone lost contact with the cell tower. Bishop must have set up a silent jammer in or near the house, blocking the frequencies used by the walkie-talkies. But that jerk spaceman had not been able to interfere with cell signals. The supervisor only needed to press the first number on speed dial to contact the local operations manager. He would have a 1-mile radius locked down in a few minutes, with a 5-mile cordon soon after. That reckless asshole Sergeant Bishop would not get far. Except that when the supervisor held the phone to his ear, he did not hear the local ops manager. He heard a sultry woman's voice.
"Welcome to Trixie's erotic chat line, where your fantasies can become reality."
Red-faced, the supervisor ended the call and pressed the numbers manually for the local ops manager, a number he had practiced calling over and over until it was burned into his memory. This time, he did not misdial a phone sex company. But the result was just as disappointing. 3 whistling tones, followed by a familiar female voice soothingly saying,
"The number you have reached is not in service. If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and dial again."
The supervisor stared at the phone, irritated at himself for pressing the wrong sequence of buttons. Then he got angry at someone else when the phone message continued. It was a snarky, arrogant voice he knew well from listening to recordings.
"Hey, shithead, I said hang up and try again. Maybe you'll get lucky."